Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
Everybody, welcome to another episode of Inside College Soccer. I don't have a college soccer guy on today, but I've got a very knowledgeable coach, and I figured since he's on the West Coast with me here in California, we could do this easily. He's on Twitter. You can find him in the Twitter sphere like almost daily at Paul J. Spacey. Paul Spacey, how are you?
I'm good, Don. Great to chat to you, mate. So first of all, thanks for having me.
Good. You're in Santa Monica, right?
I am.
Where your club is? Yes.
Yep.
All right. So right away, people are going to notice that your California accent is a little off.
Yeah, not
so
quite that.
How did you get to Santa Monica from England? How did that work?
Good question. Yeah. I moved in 2012, kind of at the tail end of my, if I can call it a semi-pro career. I was 31 going on 32 and came here originally with my ex-wife who came here to study. We came here for a year. It wasn't supposed to be any longer than that. It was just a short-term thing. Ended up meeting a guy that ran a private coaching business, got involved with him. He didn't want it anymore. I bought it from him, got an investor's visa via that, and that was it. I stayed here without intending to, and I'm glad I have because I love it here. And since then, in those 10 years or so, whatever it's been, although I'm from England, I've got a good California connection now, Don, because my wife was born and raised here. So my new wife, I should say.
Right. Well, fantastic. Well, I tell you what, people wonder why somebody like me stays in California. I was born and raised here, and you're experiencing why. And although I'm on the other end of the state, Northern California, I don't know if you've got to come up here much, is way different. I always say the two states split at the grapevine. As far as philosophical attitudes and,
yep,
and all of that, but there is nothing like Southern California, that I've ever experienced for sure.
There's not. And it's changed in the 10 years, changed a fair bit, even the time I've lived here. But even though it's changed, it's still an amazing place to live. And I know, yes, that there's a political divide and people have moved out of California and everyone talks about that, but it's still, from a climate perspective and the opportunities and everything else here, it's still an amazing place to live. It really is.
It is. Yeah. No, when you can be at the beach,
yep,
and then same day be in the snow is crazy. It's not very many places in the world where you can do that.
No. Aside from the traffic being ridiculous, that's a big downside, but we put up with that.
Well, you learn. We all learn, right? People in other parts of the country, people talk about, how far are you? In California, we say, how long is it going to take you?
Yeah, absolutely.
To live,
right,
here, because it could take you an hour to go 4 miles.
And that's true. You learn quickly. You double at least what you expect it to take, and then you might be on time.
Might.
Yeah.
Waze will save you.
Yeah. No, it's saved me all the time. Yeah.
Well, good. Well, we love having you here in California. So give us a little bit of your background as we go into this. So you said you semi-pro career. So where were you born and raised, and where did you start playing,
yep,
and fall in love and begin your senior career?
Yeah, I'll try and keep it fairly brief. I was fortunate in that my granddad was a professional. My dad played a good level. And so I had that early engagement thing. And I talk about this often on Twitter and how important that is. Tom Byers thing of football starts at home. I had that from my granddad and my dad. And so I had a big head start from that perspective. I ended up playing for quite a few years in my youth career for Stoke City. It was a good level at that time. Didn't quite make it to the professional level, but yeah, played for some decent clubs as a semi-professional for 10, 15 years. I was in a small town near Birmingham called Bedworth. The nearest Premier League club was Coventry City. And, that was my semi-pro career and loved it, learned a huge amount from it. Played, I think when I was 16, 17, started playing in adult soccer, and that was its own massive learning curve. And having gone through that myself, I encourage as many of our kids that I coach as possible, get into playing with adults as soon as you can. It's difficult. It's challenging. It can be embarrassing, but it's such a great learning curve and it helps you so much.
You know, I've talked with, we were just talking off the air about Gary at 343, and they have a real passion for the Latino community. And the one thing that the Latino community does way better than any other community I know about is that on Sunday they'll play pickup, and if your kid's 12 and can kind of hang a little bit, they'll let you play, and they'll throw you in. And it's, yeah, you're right. You learn real quick what you can get away with and what you can't get away with.
Yeah, you do. That's a massive thing in the Latino community here. In fact, my wife is half Cuban, so yeah, I always discuss it with her, and yeah, we talk about all the La Chancla and all the other stuff that she got growing up. And she's like, look, Latinos don't mess around, Paul. We get on with things. All when you're a 10-year-old, you play against the 16-year-olds. And if you get a slap and you come home crying, your mom or your dad just say, just get on with it. Get on with it. And that's, right. It's just I think it's just something that cultural part maybe we don't quite have on a large scale here yet. Would you agree?
And I think, I wholly agree. Look, this was going back 20 years ago. The United States Federation had a little program that they put out where they were going to go to every A, B, and C license in the country that was going on. And the question they were going to put to all these coaches who were working away at Bladder is, why isn't, you know, what's it going to take for American soccer to be nationally recognized? Like, oh yeah, they're in the Elite Eight of the World Cup. They're in the semifinals. Oh look, they could win it this year. Oh, what's it going to take? And my answer, I think, was different than most. And it was culture. We don't have a culture. We don't have a soccer culture. Now, if I post that on Twitter, you watch off to 40 people come back at me. Well, yes, we do. Here in Columbus, we love our Columbus Crew or whatever. That, like, that's not a soccer culture. Soccer culture is when you can go to somebody in Alaska and they go, yeah, we watch soccer. That's what our family watches. We watch it. We look forward to going down to games. And you can go to any state in the country and you can go to a grandfather. It's 80 years old. And he says, no, soccer is king in our household. That is our culture. It's what we watch. And we don't have that. We're just getting to the point. I'm 61 now. Paul, when I started, it was 1974. And
completely different landscape, right?
San Francisco Bay Area. East Bay, all of the youth teams fit on one American football field for opening day in the East Bay, which is now hundreds of thousands of kids. So that's where we started. So that means now I'm the first generation of an American whose kid grew up playing, and now his kids are growing up playing. So now when my grandson comes to our house on a Saturday morning, it's the Premier League he's going to find, and he can go find another TV if he doesn't want to watch it. But I'm watching whatever matches are on until from the moment they start until they finish, and then I go on with my day. That's culture, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Our front yard are little inflatable soccer balls that are just sitting around all the time. And if a kid kicks them, a kid kicks them, it's not a football or a baseball. I remember growing up thinking and telling my wife, even when we were married, someday it would be nice to see soccer represented on television. And people growing up now don't, here in the United States, and maybe even somebody like you coming in, may not understand really, because we turn on and it's at least a soccer ball, and it's at least it's one of the sports that they will show. In fact, they'll say soccer more than they show baseball now. So
I think that's a good point. I think it's a good point to raise, Don. I include myself in that. I think there's a lot of people that perhaps don't know the history of soccer here and where it's come from and where it is now, and perhaps are a little bit unfairly dismissive of it in that way. Like, you don't know how much progress has been made. Now, having said that, we don't just say, oh, look, we've made some progress, so we accept it and it's okay. We'll just plod along. But at the same time, culture's something that you can't force. You can push it and encourage it, right? But you can't force it upon people.
Right. Right. It's still our fifth sport.
Yeah.
It's still our fifth sport. In fact, somewhere about 3 years ago, Paul, I saw a list of rankings on through the ESPN network, and the national championship for cornhole ranked above some of the MLS soccer matches. And it's like, for viewing, watching it. Okay, yeah, we're still a long way.
Yeah.
So what changes have you noticed in the past, what is it, 13 years or so since you've been here? What changes have you noticed in the soccer landscape that tell us that it's going in a positive direction?
More kids playing. Definitely the numbers feel like they've increased. I don't know if that correlates with an actual increase if you looked at the data. I'm not sure because I don't really look at it. Feels like more kids are playing. It feels like perhaps more parents, having grown up with some of the game, are helping their kids in terms of giving them that real exposure to early engagement. And that's a massive, massive deal. The massive problem is I don't want to jump on Gary Cliburn's back and the pro rail thing and just put that at the top, but that still is the one thing that will make the biggest transformation, in my opinion. If we had promotion and relegation in this country and everything was opened up in terms of the system and the pyramid, I just think that would exponentially push the development over a period of 5-10 years quicker than it has over the last 15, 20, 25, even 30. But that's a separate topic, I guess.
Yeah, no, and I do agree. I know our culture well enough.
Yep.
To know that we are 25 years away from hoping that that will happen. People go, oh, we're so close. It's like, well, the MLS is never going to open up. It's just not. It's a single entity ownership. And by the way, when that model came into play where we have the MLS owns everything. So people don't understand what I mean. It means the MLS is the owner of all the teams and the MLS gets to decide whether you are allowed to buy a team or not buy a team, and really no amount of money can even get you into that system, although money does matter. Sacramento is a great example where they offered Sacramento verbally, you will be our next franchise, but when the franchise allotments came out, Sacramento was let down tremendously, and the promises were reneged on. And it doesn't matter that their team was in the Open Cup finals and almost pulled off an Open Cup miracle a couple years ago. It doesn't matter how good you are. There's no way that an owner can the story of the Wrexham story, and people go, oh yeah, but it's millionaires doing that, da, 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 da. I don't care who it is and how famous they are. If you don't win, you don't go up.
No, and that's the whole point is the thing with Wrexham, forget the millions or whatever. It's about sporting merit and the opportunity to be able to move up. If I started a team an adult team in Santa Monica and got investment from Will Ferrell, whose kid used to play on one of our teams, I mean, we might 10 years down the line get closer to being in MLS, but if it's not an open system, the opportunity to get there isn't there. The point is we probably won't make it to MLS in 10 years if you start at the bottom, but just having the opportunity to be able to make it, I think, is what drives investment and innovation and all the rest of it. But again, like you just alluded to, and you know it better than me, you've been around a lot longer than me, we're probably still a long way away from that happening. And so with that said, we've got to do other things to try and help football develop in this country.
All right. So let's start there then. Cause we could go on to the pro rail and talk about all the reasons all day long and all of that. We'll let Gary over 343 handle that bit of it.
Yep.
But let's talk about the things we can do then. What are some of the controllables that you could see our current landscape do differently? Soccer landscape, youth soccer landscape do differently in order to produce better players to get the U.S. to the next level on the world scale. And by the way, get American players more competitive with the international players coming into the college landscape, because it's the number one complaint, mostly on the men's side, that I get is it's not fair that this older, better, more experienced player is taking away roster spots and scholarship dollars from my American child. America first. We need to put our children first. Our kids should have an advantage over the internationals coming in. And they're not. It's not happening. So what are some of the things that you think we could do to move towards that direction of the American player being more competitive on a worldwide level?
I mean, it starts right at the bottom, first of all. We can talk about the coaches and the coaching system maybe in a minute or two, but it starts first of all right at the bottom with what Tom Beyer talks about. The football starts at home and having that early engagement with the ball. Without that, if you miss that period as a young kid, you're playing an impossible game of catch up with not only the people that are around you, but particularly the people in other countries, whether it be Europe, South America, that have had that early engagement. So does that mean if you don't start playing with a ball or get in some informal coaching or play with a parent when you're 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, that shuts the door, you can never ever be a professional? Of course not. There's outliers, but generally speaking, you listen to any interview with a professional soccer player or a player that's reached a high level, and they will say that they started playing from a very, very young age. That's a crucial period when your brain and your body's still developing. That again, if you miss that, it's almost an impossible game of catch up. And so that's the biggest thing right at the bottom. And then after that, the coaching system and the US licenses and all the other stuff, like, we've got to find a way, obviously, to try and bring the cost and the access to that, open up the access and bring the cost down. I think everyone looks at Spain as a model, rightly so. It costs a lot less to do their licenses. They have many more coaches at the higher levels of their licenses, despite having X amount of times less people in their country. And look at what it's done for them in terms of producing great coaches and great players. They're probably, I guess, the two biggest things, starting at the bottom with that early engagement and improving the level of coaching by improving the access and perhaps lowering the cost to make it more accessible to everybody.
Yeah, I tell you what I've noticed, Paul, is on the coaching education piece.
Yeah.
I noticed that people talk mostly about the United States Soccer Federation, and they don't pay as much attention to, I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
I just begun coaching in college, and I heard that the women's national team was going to do a training session in Southern California. So I talked to the head coach, we hopped in a car and we drove to Southern California and we watched the women train. And we spent 2 days sitting there with about 40 other coaches watching these women train. And the coaches spent time to talk to us and explain to what they were going. And somewhere around here, I have what I call my coaching Bible. And all it is a big old zip up binder with protected page folders in them. And somewhere in there is 2 or 3 of the activities and the coaching points from that session. By the way, it wasn't free. It was like $25. It was cheap. It was cheap. Franz Hook, I don't know if you know who he is, but Franz Hook, he was the goalkeeper coach, for those who don't know, for Ajax when they won the World Club Championship and then went on to Barcelona with Louis van Gaal. And then when Louis van Gaal went to Manchester United, he went with them and he coaches at the Federation. He puts on courses here in Northern California, Southern California. I think he had a deal, something with Orange County going on down there where he was helping and doing courses. Really inexpensive, you know?
Yeah.
$100 or so gets you in. You spend 2 or 3 days with a world-class coach and he gets a certificate, but it's not an A license and not a B license. And when I combine all of those non-traditional educational experiences, anecdotally, I will say I probably learned more from all of those combined than I learned all the way through my A license. And not that I didn't learn things in my C and my B and AA, because I did, and I met amazing coaches. But what they're teaching you is from the book, and it's not from, by the way, how did Ajax give up one goal on a free kick the entire year that they won that European national championship? One goal from set play they gave up, one, which is nobody else I've ever known has ever been able to claim that. How'd they do that? He showed us the setup of the wall and how they did it and how they organized it and why they did this. Why did they split the wall into two, by the way? They didn't use a one-man wall. And then since then, I've used a split wall because it makes sense to me. What I learned from those isn't necessarily ever anything you're ever going to pick up from your federation, no matter what federation you're in. Yet we largely ignore those learning opportunities. Todd Bean at Tobo is another one.
Yep.
If Todd Bean comes to your area, coaches, players, you sign up early because he will sell out, but you should jump on it. I visited him in Sitges Spain.
Yeah.
And I've seen his setup and I've known him for a long time, followed him a long time. And I've sat down and talked to him about philosophy, and people like that are gold, but you won't find them in your federation. What's it going to take for us to start promoting that type of thing? And, you know, maybe it's you putting on sessions and have other club coaches come in and just, hey, look, I can't do it for free because the field costs money, but I'm happy to do it for a low cost here. And my time is worth something, but I can do it fairly inexpensively, right?
I think it's a great point, right? That if we can talk about the federation being more accessible and maybe having cheaper coaching courses, but you just made the point. If you as a coach want to learn and want to grow and want to improve, there are so many people and resources out there that you can go and learn from if you want to. If you want to go and make yourself feel a bit uncomfortable and go to something that perhaps you don't feel great there, you feel a bit smaller than everyone else because you're not particularly experienced, go and do that. Go and find out. Todd Bean, yeah, his Tovo stuff's great. Lots of people that I've watched and listened to online, and I'm a good stealer, Don. I steal so much stuff from other people.
The best coaches are the best thieves, Paul.
No, there's no question about it. And I'll steal something and I'll run a session and I'll think, oh, I can tweak that and make it a little bit better and change it. And you end up with something that fits what you're doing or what you understand. If you're a real learner and you really want to learn, you can go out and find the info. And the best learning, I always put this on Twitter, trial and error. There's nothing better. Courses, forget everything else. Go on the field, try something, yeah. Mess it up, have the players look at you and go, what are we doing, coach? What are we doing? This is crap. And you'll learn way quicker than a course.
Well, if a player has to ask you three times about the setup of your exercise, or different players are asking you, you know you got something wrong.
Right.
If they don't understand what you're doing.
Right.
Yeah, no, it's so true, Paul. It's crazy because it's such a simple thing. Look, in almost every area of the country, you can find a local college somewhere near you. And for most youth coaches, that's a higher level than what they coach at. And I've never known a college coach ever. I've never met one who says the public is not allowed to watch our training sessions. Or look, if you're coaching 8-year-olds and you want to go watch the local high school coach who just won the state championship or the city championship, or they're very good and they seem to consistently win, go see why. Go watch one of their training sessions. It's free.
Yeah.
It's free. But people, it's crazy. People won't do that. And with YouTube nowadays, of course, you got to be careful of the YouTube. You got to be careful of some of the social media / training / I'm selling something sessions out there, and
definitely,
be careful,
yeah.
Because we are getting to the world of somewhere. I may still have it. I probably gave it away. At one point in my career, I bought a book called 101 Coaching Drills, Soccer Drills.
Yeah.
And that's all it was, is drills. Look, there were no coaching points in there. It was like, use this for passing. Use this. It's like, why would I use that for passing? What does it mean? Because the coaching is, and if you look in my coaching Bible I was talking about, yes, I've got the setup that they did and the exercise that they did, but everything I have with an asterisk was a coaching point. And really, that's what I was going after. It's like, so why do you want to, how can I make that crap pass crisper? Well, your toe was down, so it made your foot soft, so it didn't come off and it kind of bent. If you just raise that toe up and you lock it a little better, it gives a more solid surface and that ball will go quicker. And if you follow through at your target by stepping down at the right foot or the left foot, the ball will go more accurately towards the right or left foot. So those little coaching points are just the gold. Those are the nuggets that you're sifting and you're mining through and you go, that's a nugget. The way he said that works for my players. Good example, yeah. Paul, was heading. Somebody told me one time, imagine that you're grabbing a doorway and pulling yourself through that doorway as fast as you can.
Great one.
And I thought, oh, there's a visual that I have found has worked for every age group, every gender, from 8 years old, because who hasn't grabbed onto a doorway and pulled themselves through just for fun, right? Or can't picture that. And everything else you're trying to teach, okay, get your elbows up. Now do this. Now do that. Now do this. Now that. And you give somebody 17 steps where one word or one visualization solves 5 steps all in one. And the players get it. And suddenly they're powering through headers instead of what I call pogo sticking, right?
Yeah.
So that's an example. So How do you think we can get through to the, as you said, it starts at the bottom, right? So really, when I meet a coach, Paul, that's coaching under 19s, mm-hmm. and kid is getting ready to graduate, I know that 99% of the time that that coach will probably never coach again. I'm not worried about them because their career is over at the end. I can't really affect all the youth. But how can we get through to the coach, the moms and dads that are beginning to coach of the 4, 5, 6, 7, 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds so that we can make a difference? What are you guys doing in your club that's different?
Well, look, from a coaching perspective, for a start, we've coached, or we do coach, all different age groups. Go right down to the youngest age, up to the oldest age when they graduate to college. And that's a challenge in itself and is great for any coach. I would encourage them to go and put themselves in situations with different age groups, because each time a kid moves up 2 or 3 years, their attitude changes, their character changes, their selfishness or unselfishness changes. And as a coach, you've got to adjust. So that's a really good way to develop yourself as a coach. I don't know if you've read David Epstein's book, Range. It's brilliant. It's about
range.
It's about being a generalist I think the title is something like being a generalist in a specialized world. And it's about being good at lots of different disciplines and how you can apply that to then being a specialist somewhere and how it can help you. And that served certainly me and the other coaches well in terms of working with lots of different age groups, both genders, and all the different challenges that that brings. And it just makes you a more well-rounded coach.
Really, really good point. I had a dad ask me yesterday, do college coaches care more about the physical than the technical? It's like, oh, here we go again. Look, it's technical, tactical, physical, mental. People, can we get this down that it's a package? That yep. There's not a college coach in the world who says, I don't care at all about the technical or tactical ability. I only want players who can run fast and jump high. But yet that's the perception that we have of a lot of American coaches. That's all they care about. And I always say, yeah, it's because they can't find technical and tactical players that right. have any grasp. So they go, well, at least they're physical. At least I'll win the 50-50 battles in midfield because that kid can't kick a ball 3 yards with their left foot and they're 14 years old. And what am I supposed to do with them now? So right. for 10 years, they've never been taught and never been demanded that they be able to use their weak foot. And now I'm supposed to fix it at 14 years old. And by the way, this kid won't, I've given them all the wall exercises and they've never once gone to a wall. Not once. No. They come to practice Monday and Wednesday. They play on Saturday. And then that's it. It's the only time they'll ever touch a soccer ball again that week until the next Monday and Wednesday practice.
Yeah.
What am I supposed to do with that? So at least I'll take physical. And at least I'll take tough. And at least we won't get completely dominated. No, it's not that that's what we want. But the hardest pieces are sports psychology, right? I've got a book here somewhere, The Mindful Athlete. I don't know if you've ever read this one or not, but this guy, George Mumford, he was Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and Kobe Bryant. He was their mindfulness coach, their meditation okay. coach, brought in by Phil Jackson. He worked with Phil Jackson with every team that he had through multiple national championships. And that's the piece, like the whole psychological piece, which is why I love Dan Abraham so much.
Yeah, great, Dan.
He lays out it. By the way, people, if you follow Dan Abraham's, just pick every coach in the world should be following that man. He gives hardcore practical advice for soccer people yep. on the mental aspect of the game and what we can do to improve the mental toughness in our players. It's hard. It's hard. It's studying. That's the part, right?
It's the hardest part. The psychological side is the hardest part but also the area that can make the most impact with kids through to adults. If you're able to get it right as a coach and be able to connect with the players and help them on that psychological side, that will have a bigger impact than almost anything else. Of course, it won't make a poor technical player that doesn't understand the game very well. You can't help them with psychology and expect them to become a top player. It doesn't work like that. You just said it's all of that stuff. But the psychological side is massive, and the longer I've been involved in the game as a coach, the more I've realized how important it is.
That's going to bring me to one of your tweets that you put out. Yesterday, you posted, winning matters in youth soccer. if you don't win games, players and parents will often move to a team where they can win games. And it's a harsh reality. And that tweet kind of blew up. You got 100 likes and 27 different people comments and a bunch of reposts, and it kind of blew up. And it got me thinking about competition. And it got me thinking about how I believe that learning to be a competitive athlete is a mindset.
Yeah.
It's a skill. It's a skill. And I think we can learn to win and we can learn to lose. Arsene Wenger had a quote that went something like, if you lose one, okay, be really careful not to lose two. And if you lose three, you better figure it out really fast, because losing can, and Arsenal's going through this right now, where they suddenly don't know how to win a game that's close. They can't figure out how to get the 3 points, and they're dropping 2 points left and right by just, we could. But it's wild how many people talk about development and competitive mindset and learning how to win as if it's two different things, and as if we should only be focused on the technical and the tactical development. If we do that, we will be able to win a World Cup eventually, ignoring the whole winning piece and the competitive winning piece. I'd love to hear what prompted that tweet. What went into that? What made you think of that?
Well, it's true in the sense that if your teams in youth soccer are not winning, the parents and kids will go somewhere where they can win. And I know lots of people and coaches don't like that, and they say, oh, that's a negative attitude. Well, I'm sorry, that's just how it is. If you don't, there's some, America, Don, doesn't like losers. And I love that. I love it. We're a bit more reserved in England, and we're not like that. I love the fact that, I won't say America doesn't tolerate losers, but it doesn't like losers. And so it pushes a kind of winning attitude. Now, you can go to an extreme, and that goes too far at times, but I often hear coaches and clubs talk about development, and I know of one club from a while ago that was focused purely on development in a really, really pure sense, and they lived it. They didn't just say it, they lived it. Now, interestingly, that ended up being to their detriment, because in the early stages, the parents and kids loved it. It was only about development, only playing different positions. The result didn't matter. What we were trying to teach you was the only thing that matters. I wasn't involved in the club, but I know of it. And after a while, a season or so of losing games, people lost a bit of patience, lost a bit of faith. And in the end, it kind of ended up blowing up, and a lot of kids left, and it didn't really work out. Because I don't think you can be just about development, just in the same way as if you are only about winning and completely ignore the developmental part. Both those extremes, they don't work. You've got to find somewhere in the middle, or at least the balance between the two.
You know, I my experience, we're going 30 years ago now, and this is a completely different landscape, but when I was coaching under eights and under tens, I told the parents, if you are here to be on a winning team, you're on the wrong team, leave, because we were going to play passing football. We were going to keep the ball. We're going to teach the kids how to play. And I know that I'm not stupid. The best way to win a game, by the way, take notes, coaches out there. You want to win games? Take your biggest, strongest kid who can kick the ball farthest, and you put him in the back, and you take your very fastest kid who can run the fastest, you put him up the front, and you play the ball back to him. It's better if they have a rolling ball back to them. They can kick it even farther. So play them a rolling ball back, and you can practice this. And then they'll kick it really far, and your fast kid will outrun everybody, and you will win a lot of games, and you're not developing. Now, that is the scenario that we are seeing played out all the way up to the college game.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. That is what we see. And the reason is, as you just explained, it is the easiest way to win. The younger you are, the easier it is. My boys' 2011 team this season experienced something that we've never had with any of our teams, respectfully. I think they lost like 10 out of their 11 or 12 league games. We've never been in that position. And gradually, as the season went along, losing became a psychological problem, and they ended up losing quite a few games by one or two goals that perhaps they should have done better with. But it was difficult to get out of it. And it's just a difficult situation. I think I lost my train of thought there. Take me back to where we were 10, 15 seconds ago. Don, I feel like sometimes I have early onset Alzheimer's.
We were talking about winning and how to develop winning and the balance between building a competitive winning mindset and technical tactical development of our players and how they go through. Look, the oldest saying I probably have as a coach, and look, I stole this from somebody. I just don't remember so long ago, is that winning is a byproduct. It's not a goal. It's a byproduct of doing everything else right. And the example that the coach gave me was 1 + 2 = 3. What's magical about 1 + 2 = 3, as opposed to any other set of numbers, is there's only one way mathematically to get there. And that's, you can't say 1 + 1 = 2. And, you know, it's 1 + 2 = 3. So 3 is winning. 1 is all the technical, and then 2 is all the tactical and the physical and the mental. And it all comes together into what creates winning.
Yeah.
But if you just say we're here to win, any psychologist, including Dan Abrahams, posts about this one a lot. It's like, stop focusing on winning. Mm-hmm. Stop it. You're killing yourself by focusing on winning. When you think, I must win today, this is my career on the line. I must perform today. I'm here at tryouts and I must perform well today if my career's going to make it. You know, performing well today is focusing on winning, right? Or performing or focusing on being the best, or I've got to be better than Paul.
Yeah.
Paul's my standard. I've got to beat Paul. It's instead of, I need to get on the ball. I need to show for the ball. Okay, I'm coming in here. I've got the ball. I need to turn a little quicker. I need to open up my shape a little bit better. I can play that ball a bit quicker. Okay, that ball was a little soft. I need to drive that ball a little bit harder in feet. I see why it got intercepted. I probably shouldn't play it square across the middle of the field there. It got picked off 3 out of the last 4 times. Let me start playing angles. Let me open up my body shape a little bit more. So those are processes. Those are mental processes and physical processes. And unfortunately, if we're thinking those things in a game, like constantly, we're slow. We're a half step behind. Those things have to become automated. Like I always open up with my back to the line and I don't even think about it if I'm a winger. I've always got chalk on my boots if I'm out here and the ball's swinging. I don't do that. I don't think about those processes of trying to do the right things, that if all 11 of us win our 1v1 battles, 80% of the time today or 70% of the time today, and all 11 of us are doing that, we will win a lot of games. I don't know how many. And there's times where we will outshoot a team 27-1 and we'll lose 1-0 on a PK. That can happen, but we can remember those 2 or 3 times over our 20, 30 year career. It's so rare. It's not even worth worrying about.
And for those times, importantly, when it's just a bit of data at the end of a game, that's why it's important as a coach, right, that you assess the game and individual performance and how things have gone based on what you've worked on. Not at the end of the game, you've lost 1-0, even though you outshot them 27-1. And well, it's a disaster because we lost and the parents are all angry. No, you need to assess it in the context of what you've been working on and whether your game plan or approach works based on that, not the result at the end of the game. And unfortunately, a lot of people do place all of their focus on the result at the end of the game. And that's a problem because you then ignore the process and everything that happened to get to that point.
Okay, exactly. And it's a, you know, I have literally had senior level teams, college teams, where we smashed them scoreline. And I railed the team afterwards. If you play like that all year long, you won't even come close to making it towards your goal of winning a national title. You won't even come close because you didn't do anything. You just got lucky that they sucked.
Yeah.
Right? That doesn't mean you played well because they suck. It means, and then I've had other games where we've lost by 2 or 3 goals. And I said, I've never been more proud of you.
Yep.
You did everything we've ever asked of you in training. You did everything right. And I'm sorry the results didn't go your way, but I'm not crying over this one.
Right.
We lost. Big deal. They were better than us, but you did everything right. Now take that as a building block and then let's build on it. And tomorrow will be a little better and the next day will be a little better and the next day will be. But there's your building block, folks. There's your foundation. That's foundational football, I call it, right? Foundational football is how we play at the base of our core, technically and tactically, how we understand the game as a team and how we perform technically within those individual and group 1v1, 2v1, 2v3, 4v2, Rondo-esque moments. Yeah. How do we play Rondo all the way down the field and do we recognize the spaces, right? Oh, there it is. We've sucked. I was, it sounds almost this saying, I because of our culture, bastardizing words, I'm just giving a warning to this phrase. Nobody, I'm not trying to talk rude. Suck them in and split them out. Suck them in and split them out. In other words, bring them in, now play past them into the space that you just created because you brought them in, right? Yeah. If we can get our team understanding these concepts, man, in long run, developmentally, and we will win a lot more than we lose.
Right. Right. Dan Abrams and others talk about that, controlling the stuff that you're able to control, right? That's the only thing you're able to do. I think a lot of people dismiss the fact that, I know people say, look, it's not about luck. You make your own luck. To an extent, for sure you do. But what book was it? I can't think what book it was I read, and soccer games assessed over however many years at the top level. And it's like almost 50% chance in every game in terms of how it ends up. It might be a ball that comes off the crossbar and goes in or doesn't, or deflects off somebody. But how it ends up is often not reflective of what you've put into the game individually and collectively. And so controlling the things that you can control and assessing how you've done based on your approach and what you've been working on in practice, that's the only thing that you should really be looking at as a coach. And if you can educate your players, kids and parents that that's how it works, there's a better understanding and you'll get buy-in. And in the long term, that's better for you. And I think that's one thing, certainly for my club, and I drive that for the most part, where we've managed to have success, because I think for the first 5 or 6 years, it's changed a bit over the last 2 or 3 because of ECNL and some of the bigger clubs pulling away players. It's natural. Our player retention rate was like 95%, which is completely ridiculous for a youth soccer club. But it's because we were very, very clear from the outset, this is how it is. This is how it's going to work. And we'll do our best to educate you. And it worked. It worked. But again, the last couple of years have been much more challenging because the landscape has changed a bit now.
It has. So where do you see, if you had a magic crystal ball and you could gaze into the future, say 10 years down the road, where do you see this youth landscape continuing to morph into? Or do you see a pullback from what we have with ECNL? Look, ECNL is so unique. I've never seen anything like this in my career. I remember the first time I heard from a buddy of mine. He coaches out of Vegas, and he was coaching an ECL club in Las Vegas at the time. And he said, oh, we've got this new league, this Elite Clubs National League, and we're going to be traveling to Virginia to play. And I'm thinking, what's the insanity here? Are you crazy? You live a couple of hours from Southern California. The number one youth soccer market on planet Earth is Southern California. Not even remotely close. I'm not going to argue with anybody about this. There are seconds and thirds, you know, the DC metro area and the Dallas metroplex and all of that. They're good, but they all pale in comparison to what we see coming out of Southern California. Mm-hmm. Why would you travel to the other side of the country to play games? By the way, when you go to a tournament, if you get into the semifinals, you'll end up playing another team from Southern California. So we have SoCal whatever playing against SoCal whatever. It's like, what are we doing here, folks?
This is the one area of, certainly, I mean, I've only been exposed really to Southern California, although I've been in Arizona a fair bit. I've got a house there. But there's no need to travel here more than an hour for a game against a competitive team, in my opinion, apart from the 1% outliers that require that because they're at such a high level, they need it for competition. Outside of those 1%, the other 99% should be traveling 45 minutes to an hour, absolute max, to play a competitive game on the weekend. I've never been on board with it. I never will be. The ridiculous travel. I find a team flying or whatever, however they get there, to another state to play a game, utter insanity. I think one of the quotes I read was, you don't get better while you're traveling on a plane. And it's true. Like, you can't improve while you're on a plane for 4 hours. It's ridiculous. And I think the way it's gone, and expanded, one of the other posts I did maybe 6-7 months ago about the number of leagues in Southern California blew up. And there's now 14 or 15, I think. Maybe it's even more than that, but in the youth soccer landscape, again, ridiculous. All it's done is watered down the talent, again, individually and collectively across the board, because there's so many leagues here now. And just like the pendulum always swings back and the universe is expanding and in the end it's going to contract upon itself, I think the same is true for youth soccer. We'll end up having so many leagues and it will be so watered down the smaller leagues will collapse, some of the others will get swallowed up by the bigger ones, and will eventually come back to a more centralized system, which I believe is what Coast Soccer League used to be here, where almost everybody played in that league.
It is. It's what it used to be. Look, I used to coach ODP, and now people are going to go, ooh, ODP. Look, Olympic Development Program was how you got onto the national team.
Yeah.
For 80% of those players out there. That's how they made it. And we're talking 20 years ago, right? But the match of the year was NorCal against SoCal. When NorCal played SoCal, there would be 60 college coaches on the sidelines. When you go to regionals, and it was always in Idaho, you'd go to regionals, it was loaded with college soccer coaches. You could see the best kids from every state. And so not only was talent ID easier to find those national team kids, and then we were bringing them into residence for a good chunk of time in Bradenton, Florida, before IMG was IMG.
Yeah.
When it was Boletari Academy, we would hold them in residence there, and those players would live for a year together and train for a year together. And no shock that we were beating Portugal in World Cup. We were making it to Elite Eights. We were making it on the world stage and competing. We were tying Brazil.
Yeah.
In competitive matches. It's crazy how we had this progress, and then privatization of mm-hmm. the youth system killed it all. It killed it all. And while our women are still top two or three in the world arguing, depending on who you want to, we are not dominant like we were for a number of reasons. Fair enough. England right. finally decided they're going to give a crap about women's soccer, and Spain finally decided we're going to give a crap. We're going to care, because they did not care at a certain point.
No other countries investing in women's soccer is certainly a big factor in that, in the change.
It is. Title IX, all of that that other countries didn't have. However, would be logical with our population size over Spain, let's say, that we would maintain that dominance. And now we're not. Least on the women's side. On the men's side, we've never been even remotely close to being mentioned in the same conversations, say Spain. Right. So you think we're going to see you think the pendulum will eventually swing? Cause we're going on probably 15 years of ECNL, I'm guessing, something like that. You think we will see a pendulum shift?
I do. I mean, look, ECNL is, for however many years now, what, 3 or 4 years have had ECNL regional league now, which is now the next division down from ECNL. And I just think it will be, whether it's ECNL or MLS next or girls academy, I don't know, DPL, but the bigger named leagues, I think will end up swallowing up the smaller ones that can't survive financially. Because let's face it, the reason they're all in operation is money. That's like you said, it's the privatization. So they operate from a financial incentive. And eventually all of those smaller ones are going to reach a point where the time you're putting in and the money you make probably isn't worth it. Let's just join up with a bigger league and we'll filter our teams into them. And look, the clubs in youth soccer have gone very much the same way. The smaller clubs are getting eaten up by the bigger ones. And so that's gone the same.
Crazy. You go to Alaska and you see the Surf brand name and I'm going, where's the waves? Where's the surfing? It's not in Iowa, Surf, whatever. And I'm going to only pick on Surf because I don't know. Might be the biggest brand? I don't know. I see a lot of teams. That's what I'll tell you. In the same city, you might have, you know, 5 surf teams in the same city. So yes, I know where you're. And Rush does the same thing, by the way, and Albion. Some of these clubs are it just becomes a, yeah. I notice the product doesn't change though. I can't figure that piece out. Like, so what's the incentive for that? We don't have to answer that question, but what's the incentive? Because I notice that the product on the field doesn't ever change because they change names. Ever.
So I mean, that's because that's ultimately driven by the coaches and the personnel, right? I mean, you can change your hat, your kit, your name a million times, but what's happening on the field and the product you see is driven by the people. And so if the people don't change or the education of those people doesn't change, nothing's going to change.
That's as simple as that, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. Lipstick on a pig.
Yeah.
It is what it is. Okay, so we're getting to the point here. We're going to start wrapping this down, but what message? Let's talk to parents for a minute. Okay, so we've talked about players and their development. You know, all the things that they should be doing, sports psychology. By the way, nutrition, something we didn't talk about, but nutrition and sleep are two very underrated performance enhancers that people don't talk much about.
Massive, and sleep is at the top of the list, Don. If you get sleep wrong, your nutrition and everything else is almost immaterial.
Fitness, all of it, right?
Yeah.
All of it. Especially for youth.
Especially for youth, and that's where it's most difficult for them. And I talk to kids about it and say, look, I do feel a bit sorry for you in this generation now because of social media and all the pressures and everything that goes with that. We didn't have it. We played on the field for 7-8 hours. We had a break in between sometimes. You'd go and ride your bike. You'd have a fight with your mate. You'd go back to the field and play again and finish at 10 p.m. You'd go home, no shower, no food, fall into bed and go to sleep, and you'd have 10 hours, no problem, and be up the next day. We had a simpler time, Don, for sure, when we were younger. There's no question about it.
Yeah. Some of these poor kids are, you know, getting picked up from school, driven 2 hours to training session, and sometimes they're there an hour early so they can start getting some homework done, or they're doing it on the way. And then they get home at 10 o'clock at night. They've got more homework to do. They haven't eaten yet. And then by the time they get done checking with all of their friends on Insta and Snap and everything, then it's midnight. And then the alarm clock's going off at 6 a.m. and they got a solid 5.5 hours sleep, and then they're going to go try to perform.
It's not sustainable. It isn't sustainable.
Tournaments. Look, in England, you're not traveling time zones. If you are going from London to Manchester for some reason to play, it's a day. You could do it in a day trip, and you're not changing time zones.
Yeah.
Now we're changing time zones in the U.S., which screws with our circadian rhythms and screws with our sensitivity to light. And it takes us 2 or 3 days to adjust on one side and 2 or 3 days to adjust on the other. So we've lost a week or more of peak performance time, or potential peak performance time. We've skipped it because we're asking our kids to skip 2 or 3 time zones to go play a league game. It's crazy.
Simplify things again. Stop the crazy travel. Stop all the other craziness. Get away from being on social media and locked into it all the time. Go back to more simplicity. Kick the ball against a wall for a few hours. Go and play down the park with your friends. The simple approach is always the best approach, or often is the best approach, but it feels like complexity and flashiness is where we've moved to now, and that doesn't produce results.
So I'm a youth parent. You just told me that. And I'm going to say, but my kid won't be able to get scouted by a college if I don't do this CCNL thing. My career is over. What do you tell that parent?
I mean, surely for any parent, or for any kid, I should say, your primary goal or your primary intention is just to get as good as you can possibly be and what your genetics will allow you to be. How do you do that? Is that the external things of having a badge on your arm, or is it doing the ball against the wall, playing with your friends, playing on a team that's good enough that's going to push you? I mean, it seems straightforward to me, but I understand from a parent's perspective, with all of, whether it be the marketing and the messages you get and the FOMO that comes in, it feels like you have to be involved in whether it be a certain league or a certain team or doing a certain thing or going to a specific state or a particular tournament. That becomes the thing that you have to do. And it's such a misguided concept, right? Because at the end of the day, the college coaches ultimately are still looking for the best possible players for their program. And so if you're someone that's come through, let's use the Latino leagues as an example. Financially, you may not have been able to afford playing for a particular ECNL club and you couldn't get a scholarship. And so you played on Saturdays and Sundays in a Latino league. You've become an exceptional player. You're in high school. You find a way to put together, and if you can't do it yourself, whatever, you get some help. My players often ask me, put together a highlight reel. You haven't played for that massive ECNL club, but the coach is still assessing what he sees on that video and then ultimately seeing you in person, not particularly looking at the badge on your arm. Now, having said that, you know better than me, Don, on this. I have heard many times now that coaches are put in some attention on which league you've played in. Because then it's, hey, he or she has played in this particular league, so they have a certain pedigree or a certain caliber to have actually played in that league in the first place, which makes some sense. But ultimately, you're still judging the player on what they're able to do in their video and in person. And again, you can speak more of this. You're much more experienced on that than me.
No, you're right. Well, look, there is a pecking order. So if I have a player, because we have an office in England, we also have an office in Spain. So occasionally we will get, we've got a goalkeeper from Manchester United's, under 19 youth team. She's a good goalkeeper. Don't get me wrong. She's good. I've seen better Americans, but she's very good. Very good. Just based on the words Manchester United, she was getting offers. Don't have to come to my campus. Don't have to come to a trial. Don't do anything. Your film looks good, because somebody else who we assume knows something about soccer gave the stamp of approval to that player.
Yeah.
They did the work for me. She's number three or four in the England youth national team setup, right? She's training with the national team. So somebody else who I'm assuming has a good amount of soccer knowledge and experience gave that player a stamp of approval. And I say that's fair. Like at most levels I coached on, I would have signed her no film.
Okay.
Because somebody else did the work for me. I'm not stupid. If the England national team staff who's watching things on a world level, and by the way, if they don't win, will be fired, is putting their trust in this person, who am I to say not good enough for my team? You know, that's crazy. Now, if I'm Randy at Pitt, maybe she doesn't fit for me, because I've also can look at the Norwegian national team keeper and the Canadian national team keeper and the whatever, Spanish national team keeper, who are all interested in coming over here. Well, no, so on the women's side, that goes on, but on the men's side, it also happens. Not often we get I've got two Bundesliga guys, one played for Ingolstadt, and, you know, he was playing for their reserves team as a goalkeeper and was smart enough to realize, I think the mountain's too high for me to actually make a living at this. Yeah. I could go play for a second or third division team and spend my whole career bouncing and trying to build a pro career. And yeah, I could make a living, but at the end of the day, I'm probably going to work in a Mercedes-Benz factory.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what he was doing part-time anyways. At the end of the day, I'd rather go get my degree in America, because when I come back to Germany, I won't be on the assembly line at Mercedes-Benz.
Yeah.
It'll be something different. Maybe I can be a manager at Mercedes-Benz or something different, right? But the point is that there is a pedigree to this. And one of the comments that we will get, so if I pull up a player, a girl from some other league, and that's not ECNL. And then I pull up a clip of a similar player to her that's playing in ECNL. Yeah, ECNL looks more frantic and faster.
Absolutely. I completely
absolutely more frantic and faster. So this other one, the question is, are they going to be able to keep when the game is more frantic and faster and there's less time and space to perform? I got a question mark. And now that player, so what ECNL does for all of you out there and what MLS Next does is it takes the skids and it puts grease on them so that when I pull it, it just pulls easier. It greases the skids and it makes it easier to get in front of coaches. But if you're not number one or two on the top 15 or 20 better teams, in other words, if you are the 15th best player on your whatever number of ECNL teams there are, on the 75th best ECNL team, and you're the number 15 player on that team, ECNL did you zero good. You got good competition, but that level of competition that you can actually play against and compete with can easily be found in Southern California without leaving, or Northern California, or DC metro area, or Florida metro area, you know, Miami metro, or in, you know, Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex, Pacific Northwest. Easily, same level.
That makes a lot of sense. And hearing it from you and someone as experienced as you, that's enlightening and educational for me being a club coach. And I think for the most part, the thing that I say to parents is your kid needs to find the right level for them. Just as you talk about the right fit for a kid going to a particular college, they need to find the right level and the right fit for them while they're in their youth career, if you can call it that. Because, yeah, look, if you are, as you just said, the lower level player on a mid or lower level ECNL team, does that enhance your college prospects? I don't know, probably not. But if you're at the upper end, it does. But look, ultimately, find the right team for you. Find the right level for you. Don't go and join a particular team or a particular league just for the sake of doing that. Especially, I feel sorry for them. Bless them. The parents that push the kids or the kids push themselves onto a particular team just to be on that team. And then they ride the bench for the entire season, but they don't mind because they can just say they're on the team. And I feel bad for them because you're just like your semi-pro career for me as an adult. It's short and goes in the blink of an eye. Your youth career is exactly the same. It's gone. So you've got to be playing. You just need to be playing. In youth soccer, that should be your primary goal. Play as much as possible. And if you're on a team where you're not playing, talk to the coach and find out why. And if you can't figure it out really, really quickly, find a team where you're going to play.
So it's always when I advise kids this way when they go into college, Paul, it's you don't want to be on a team where everything is so easy. When you walked into it, you are now the golden child with everybody bowing to you. And it's so easy that you can walk through and waltz through people. That's not healthy in life for any of us to have zero competition because you're so good. Other hand, other side, you don't want to go into a team where the bar is set so high and you are so far behind that you get destroyed mentally, because no matter how hard you work, you were so far behind to begin with that you can't catch up. You just can't catch up. I mean, you've all decided to climb Mount Everest together and you gave them a 30-day head start to base camp. And now you start at the bottom and they start climbing and you're expected to beat them to the top of Mount Everest is probably never going to happen. I suppose it could. Maybe their whole expedition falls into a crevasse and you do make it. But other than that, you're not going to catch them because they had a head start over you.
Yeah.
It is really difficult. And this goes to college too, Paul, when I advise people about college. And we're seeing right now all these girls to all these ACC and Big Ten and Big 12, Power Four, national championship level schools going, oh, I'm so excited that I'm going to be, that I failed here. I'm so excited that I wasn't good enough to be here. And so I'm so excited to be looking for something else. Well, yeah, I hope you're excited that you have realized how high the mountain was and that you weren't good enough, which is the bottom line. If you were good enough, the coach would be begging you to stay and would be doing everything in their power to get you to stay if you were going to make an impact in their team. And that word impact, I can't use enough, because that is the number one phrase we get from college coaches is, I need an immediate impact, insert the position.
Yep.
Does any coach in the world on a competitive level, Paul, are they jonesing for another number 18 on their roster? Anybody at any level you've ever heard of in your life, they're just jonesing for another person who will not help them win. Because that's what the parents say. Well, her teammate is playing at Notre Dame. And I look it up and I'll go, she's played 0 minutes in 2 years.
Yeah.
So I don't know what playing at Notre Dame, not to pick on Notre Dame, has nothing to do with Notre Dame. First big name that came into my head. Could be Stanford or any other big school. But her teammate, I always love this one too. The girl that's at such and such a school, she used to destroy in training all the time. And she used to destroy in games and she dominated them. And I can't get a single college coach to call me back. It's a disconnect. It's an unrealistic disconnect. And I don't know how this works, but I will tell you that if somebody is dominating the ECNL landscape, and I've seen these players. I had a girl a couple of years ago, Paul, center back at IMG, contacted us, said, come out and look at me. We might need your help. And I went out to watch her and she was a whole other level of different.
Yeah.
Whole another, and she's playing and played since freshman year at a very good level. And there were probably 200 college coaches at that game. And every one of them that I talked to was there to watch her.
Right.
Now, isn't that interesting? Because on social media, half the girls from both teams said thank you to all these coaches for coming out and watching me and us play.
Yeah.
Girls, they didn't even know you existed. I guarantee they don't know your name or your number because they were all here watching this girl who is a future professional player in the making. We're watching it happen before our eyes. She was warming up the team. She was laying down the cones. She was doing high level captain stuff. Get in here. Let's go. And they would listen to her. And she did it in a nice, kind way. And they were, how do you feel today? Like, our results depend on you. You're that much of an impact player. Like, how many kids, boys and girls, do we see at a collegiate level? I mean, at a youth level, Paul, that are that player, right?
Yeah. No, very few. And we, in the 10 years I've been running the club, we've had two boys. One of them was formerly a American football player and just a ridiculous genetic freak athlete. And, you know, I think we had him for 3-4 years and we knew after having him for a year, the kid's going to go and play D1. He was destroying everyone athletically, but we helped him nurture him on the football side. And yeah, he's at CSUN now and he's doing well there. And then we had one other kid who's the most talented kid I've ever worked with. Unbelievable 6'4" or 6'5" lefty. An outrageous talent that should have gone probably higher than college. Ultimately, and I've heard you guys talk about this on podcasts, his grades let him down. His grades let him down badly. And that, I think that closed a lot of doors for him. And he also didn't quite have the personal drive necessary to take him where he should have gone. I mean, if I'd have had his left foot, forget playing on the Stoke City youth team to go with my right foot, I'd have ended up on TV. No problem. But yeah, so unfortunate and frustrating seeing that. And I'm sure you've seen it.
Technical, tactical, physical. And there's the mental piece you talked about. That's a mental issue. Has nothing to do with if he could kick a ball, had nothing to do with physical genetics, had nothing to do with his understanding of the game. He let him, somebody in his career at some point at home, whatever, wasn't able to get him to lock in on the mental side of the game. And that's, dude, stay focused. You got a job to do here, man. You know?
Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah. And usually, by the way, football starts at home. Usually that stuff stems, not always, it usually stems from home. Look, yeah. My son understood very early on, and he went, played a couple of years in England, had a Bundesliga trial with Cologne, and did okay D1. He still holds some records at his school in the conference. So he was an okay footballer, not good enough to play pro. But he said one time, when he was getting ready to come from England back here to the U.S., John Kerr was coaching at, the Duke coach was coaching at Harvard. And he heard about my son or saw his film or, there was interest. We had a conversation. He says, send over your transcripts. And John laughed, said, Don, not even close. I said, well, you didn't ask what his grades were. You said, send over transcripts, 2.89 GPA, something like that. And my son said, well, that was all that was required of me to get to the level of school that I thought I was going to go to. If I had known Harvard was going to come after me, I think I probably could have got straight A's. I wasn't interested. Yeah. I wanted to play football. That's why I was going to college. To play football because it was an extension of my football career. And if you listen, I had a podcast with Bruce Murray. If you haven't heard that one yet, it's very interesting on Inside College Soccer. Bruce Murray, when he retired, was the leading goal scorer, I believe, in the U.S. national team at the time. He was, he played for Creighton. He played for, now I've gone brain dead. I'll come up with it in a second. He won a national championship and Bruce, ended up playing professionally and played over in England for a little while with John Kerr. And he said, look, at every level, high school and then college, it was just an opportunity for me not to have to quit because I loved the game that much. I just didn't want to quit the game. I wanted to continue playing.
Yeah.
And Paul, I can't stress this enough to parents. If you can get your kids into that mindset where all they care about is playing the game and they're in love with the game, trust me, they will reach their full potential as a footballer.
Yeah. Yeah.
They will. No, Whatever that is, they will reach it.
Yeah. No, it's true. Fostering that love for the game and having it. Yeah, because without that real love for it, you don't go and kick the ball against a wall for 3 hours. You go out with your friends instead. You don't go and play pickup games. You don't, as a 13, 14-year-old, like I did back home, go and join in with adults and let them smash you into a brick wall in a tiny little gym with 20 of you, because you don't love it. You're not going to go and do that. And it's such a, oh, such a fantastic developmental tool. And to quickly touch on gap years for kids, occasionally the odd kid will approach me and say, look, my dad's got a European passport, German or whatever. What do you think? I've got the opportunity to have a gap year. And, or a few of them ask me about England. Can you put me in touch with semi-professional teams? And I'm like, please go for a year. Please go and have that experience and go and play against semi-pro players. And someone will try and snap you in half in the first 5 minutes of the game. The fans will be shouting at you and you'll get that experience. And you can go back to college for 4 years and be a bigger, stronger, better character and a way better football player.
Oh, I couldn't have asked for a better wrap up to our podcast than what you just gave us right there. That is freaking, parents, bookmark that, write it down, listen to it 10 times if you need to. That is solid gold. If you really want your kid to understand what the potential is of our game, get them the heck out of the United States for a period of time. They need to leave. They need to go see what they're doing in Spain or England or Germany or whatever. They need to see the difference. It made all the difference in my son's not only career, but life.
I'm sure. Yeah.
What he learned doing that. Thank you, Paul, for coming on. Paul, I want everybody to know before we go here, people are going to have questions. How can they reach out to you? How can they learn more about what you're doing? Tell us about some of your projects.
Yeah, Twitter's the best place, I get. I still find it difficult to call it X. But yeah, Twitter's the best place to, if you want to send me a direct message or whatever. You'll find me on Instagram as well. I post on there most weeks. And again, you can inbox me there. Aside from that, if you want to go to my club website, you'd be able to get my email address and contact me. It's www.fcengland.com. I don't know why I said www then. I'm like back 30 years ago when
That's
we had
how
to
old
say
you
it.
Are.
Jesus.
That's a shame.
The kids
like
now
talking
will be laughing.
About my phone book.
Oh my God.
My Rolodex. Yeah. At least you didn't say Rolodex, right?
Oh my God. Yeah. Anyway, fcengland.com, you'll find me. And, reach out. People do all the time, whether it's on Instagram, Twitter, or even sometime through TikTok, and just ask a question. I'm happy to help because people need the help. And you do, I know you do it all the time, Don. We just provide help for as many people as possible and try and help them get further in the game.
Look, you're the same as me. You don't bug anybody, but I think we probably have the same philosophy. And that's, if you need help, just ask. Yeah. All you got to do is ask. Right. And I'll try to point you the right direction. Real quick commercial here. Everybody out there, transfer season is here. The women's portal opened up today. The men's will open up next week. CollegeSoccerTransferPortal.com, all one word. It is free. Don't know how long it's going to be free, but for the nearest foreseeable short future, it's free. College coaches, we've got over 100 college coaches have requested access. We've got more signing up every day. We've got 50, 60 girls on there and about 90 or 100 guys on there. What this is if the college, the NCAA transfer portal has very limited information for coaches. So it has all Division I, you have to be in there. Division II, you need to be in there. Division III, you don't have to be in there, but a lot of people do. It gives the name of the player, basically, how to do the email address and what school they were at. And then that's it. So the college coach has to go and get a bunch of information. We needed something. College coaches needed something. And look at me still with the we, like I'm still coaching college. I can't get out of that habit. We need something that has junior college and NAIA and Division III and Division II and Division I all in one place. And we need more information. We need film. We need their grades. We need their, what can they afford, right? Their affordability of college. What was their background and how do I get a hold of them? So, at college transfer portal, collegesoccertransferportal.com, coaches can get access. So if coaches are listening to this, please let us know. We will grant you access, once we verify your email address as being a .edu. And for players, free access for you. Just sign up, super easy. One for the men, one for the women. That's collegesoccertransferportal.com. Thanks, Paul, for sitting with me through that. And,
my pleasure, Don.
We'll be talking on Twitter.
We will. That was wonderful. Okay. Thanks a lot, mate. I appreciate it.